This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I am Mira Sivasodhi. In our Health and Living segment for his monthly show, Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon. Today we're discussing getting a grip on your hand and wrist problems. I think this is something that's going to be a problem going forward, just like, you know, our neck and lower back issues. Hand and wrist problems are on the rise. What is it we're actually discussing? Well, if you have a question for him, give us a call. The number is 03-77-109-000. Tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Welcome to the show, Dr. Rajesh.
Thank you, Mira. Always a pleasure to be here.
This is something very much your alley because you have sort of subspecialized in this area.
I prefer to call it an interest. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one of those things that I looked at sort of all of orthopedics and said, well, you know, what tickles me? Soft tissue really tickled me, you know. So I like dealing with a lot of soft tissue. Bone is pretty straightforward. You know, if you've got basic carpentry skill, you can work with bone. But soft tissue requires really a much broader skill set. And when you're dealing with small bones in the hand, for example, the skill set required is a lot more that of a tailor rather than of a carpenter. So it's one of those sort of things that just sort of follow the interest in, you know, lots of soft tissue in the hand.
What do you mean by soft tissue?
Okay, so let's start with skin. Under skin is a layer of stuff called fascia. Then under the fascia you have, so that's two, then after the fascia you have tendon. Other than the tendon you have nerve, then you have ligament. You have artery, vein. Those are all the soft tissues. Anything, joint capsule, synovium, really anything other than sort of bone, the hard stuff that you see on an X-ray, all of that soft tissue. So it's kind of interesting that, you know, we spend a lot of time looking at X-rays, but X-rays really only show us the bone. And the joint, the place where two bones meet is called a joint. So you can look at a joint, you can look at an X-ray and have an indication of sort of what may be going on in the joint. But really, it's about bone.
What is it about the hand and the wrist that, what's happening inside it that's very different from the rest of the musculoskeletal system?
Okay, look, the hand's a little bit unique in the sense that you've got lots of really delicate structures packed into a really tight, small space. So the sort of analogous region may be sort of the base of the head and neck, where you've got sort of surgical specialties that deal with problems at the base of the head and neck. In Malaysia, hand surgery does exist as an independent subspecialty. So we train in orthopedic surgery, and then from orthopedic surgery, you can sort of branch off to whatever your area of interest is. In Europe, hand surgery is taken up by plastic surgeons as well as orthopedic surgeons. In the US, it's largely orthopedic surgeons. In Malaysia, it's almost, I'd say, 99% orthopedic surgeons who end up taking up hand surgery. It's just sort of the way services developed. I think the reason why hand surgeons sort of developed as a subspecialty or people with sort of a hand interest got together is because if you don't treat a hand injury right the first time, you get a bad outcome. You know, there's no two ways about it. And we know this from many, many years of experience worldwide. If somebody has a hand injury and is treated in a dedicated hand facility with people who work with hand all the time, they get a better result. If they are treated where someone does a I try and see, inevitably the result's a lot poorer. So I think it's probably not unreasonable to have hand surgery as a subspecialty, just given the complexity of surgical work as well as rehabilitative work involved in treating hand injuries.
What are we doing today that's sort of, are we misusing our hand and our wrists?
I think the idea with the hand is, the function of the hand is a prehensile organ. So you reach out around you, everything that you do involves the hand. What we're doing now these days requires a lot more fine manual work. So, you know, working on your phone, working on keyboards, all the stuff which involves hands where you get to the limit of the function of the hand. You know, so if your job was, you know, chopping wood, shoveling, things like that, that's a relatively crude use of the hand. But in Asian cultures as well, because we eat with our hands as well.
Yeah.
Right? So it's any dysfunction in the hand is a huge loss. You know, people say if they have a hand injury, they say, I'm forced to eat with instruments now.
Mm-hmm.
As in, like, their preference would be to eat with their hand.
Yeah.
And they can't eat with their hand. So,
and our obsession about how you cannot eat with the left hand.
That's cultural.
Very, you know,
like,
cultural.
Like sort of anything else. But again, I have a very dear patient who is a deaf mute, and she had an injury to her wrist for which she was put into a cast. Now, in that situation, having put her into a cast wasn't such a big deal, except that she then lost the ability to communicate, right? Because she signs.
Yeah.
So we don't really consider all the... I think the hand is one of those things best appreciated in its absence.
Absolutely.
Right? So you try and immobilize the hand and you try and do anything in life and it's just, well, can't do it.
And so let's take texting and the fact that we love our gadgets today. How do you think that's abusing the hand and the wrist? I can't see it. I mean, it's a light object. Mm. I can't see why we would be, you know, misusing it any way.
Okay, so the analogy I give with this is, let's take a piece of paper and an eraser or maybe even a pencil. If you draw across the piece of paper even lines with the pencil throughout the whole piece of paper, if you erase the lines evenly across the whole piece of paper, you don't damage that piece of paper. Now, if you just stick with one little section on that paper and you keep drawing a pencil mark in there, you'll tear the paper.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically what we're doing wrong. If you say to me, what are we doing wrong with our hands? We're not going through full range movements. We're just sort of we're making repetitive movements in a very small range. And the body's not made to work like that. The body's made to work through sort of a full range of movement, not short, repetitive strokes.
But then again, what were we doing before that got us going in this repetitive movement in a full range?
Mm-hmm.
What were we doing before?
We actually weren't doing the wrong thing. We weren't doing the right thing necessarily,
mm-hmm.
but we weren't doing the wrong thing. So let's take sort of the example of a typist. So what a typist would do is they would sort of take a sheet of paper, they would flatten it out, they would put it into the typewriter and they would sort of spool it up,
yep.
all big movements of the hand. They would then do their clickety-clackety-clickety-clackety, and the clickety-clackety involved large excursion of the fingers. You actually moved through a big range in order to effect the keystroke.
Right.
And then you took the paper out again. So your work that you did, or the period of work that you did, was physically restricted by the law of, you know, well, the paper's big, you have to handle it, you've got to stick it into the machine. What's happened now is we've made it possible to do the same thing for 12 hours. And you can sit and play games on your phone for as long as the battery will last. 2 hours, 3 hours, 4 hours, 5 hours. Those things didn't exist before. So when those things didn't exist before, you didn't end up doing the wrong things.
But what would be the consequences of that, though? What's happening to the hand and wrist as we just continue to work with our gadgets with this very limited range?
We tend to irritate things. So it's really more pain. A lot of the hand and wrist conditions that I see are principally pain-related. You know, they're the common ones, like carpal tunnel, trigger finger, a couple of nerve entrapments, lumps and bumps around the wrist. But by and large, people say their hands hurt, and that then limits sort of a quality of life kind of thing, saying, I can't do this, that, or the other because my hands hurt.
Do you see pain in the hand as a result? I mean, can you actually say it's because we're spending too much time on our gadgets?
Okay, well, I'll tell you, I saw a two-year-old boy who was brought in with his voice for something else by his parents, and mum said to me, oh, can you look at his thumb? Because he sometimes complained that his thumb hurts. And he's gripping on to this sort of toy thing with an interactive screen. And when he releases the toy, he's got a pressure mark down the middle of his thumb.
Right.
From the pressure of gripping the toy in the excitement of playing with the toy. Right. So that toy obviously is causing the child's thumb some pain. Now, not causing him any harm, but it is causing pain.
Yeah. Do you think the part of the brain that controls the hand and the wrist will evolve with time as we just continue to continue with this limited range of movement and will that alter how the brain connects with the hand going forward?
I don't think on an evolutionary perspective, but I think certainly on a developmental perspective, yes. So the brain is reasonably plastic, especially in the earliest of development. So if you do something from an intensive level at an early age, there are adaptive changes in the body. I mean, things that I've seen that have surprised me are musicians. So I remember treating, I think it's third musician, who had been training for music from a very young age, sort of probably 2-3 years old. And these are instruments that they play with their hand, like, you know, the guitar, the piano, the violin.
Yep.
And these people ended up having injuries and unfortunately needed surgery. And the thing that struck me about all of these three people is that their nerves were massive, right? So the nerve which carries signals to the hand and the nerve which carries signals back from the hand, the nerve was actually massive, much, much bigger than I would have expected in someone of the same age, gender, and physical size. So there's an adaptation of the body to use from childhood, which shouldn't really surprise us.
Why is the nerve bigger?
Interesting question. I don't know. I just assume that the nerve has been more developed in the years that it took for the child to grow up because of use. You know, so it's the same with athletes. I will look at somebody who's been playing tennis from a young age, right, 5 or 6, and you can see that half of the body is overdeveloped. Like literally, the skeleton's bigger, the bones are bigger, yeah, everything's bigger.
I mean, you can take swimmers for an example.
Yeah, you can take swimmers, but you know, swimmers are symmetrical, so you can just say swimmers have broad shoulders as sort of a general statement. But if you want to take a critical analysis, it'd be easier to compare, you know, a racket sports person because they use one hand more than the other.
Yeah.
And then you can say, well, you know, these are the developmental adaptations. No reason why it shouldn't apply to nerves.
Okay, so the red flags that something is wrong with the hand and the wrist, what would they be? We'll come back and find out more up next. But if you have a question on hand and wrist problems, I mean, there you go, carpal tunnel syndrome. What else, Dr. Rajesh? I think there are quite a lot of things we're going to be covering. Arthritis, for an example. What kind of sporting activities that involve the hand and the wrist injuries. And sometimes, especially when it's occupationally related, it can be an issue as well.
Yes,
so if you have a question for us, give us a call. The number is 03-7710-9000. Tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodi. Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant, orthopedic surgeon, in the studio with me. We're discussing getting a grip on hand and wrist problems. I think, as you mentioned, Dr. Rajesh, we sort of take our hands and wrists for granted until something really happens and you can't use it anymore. But it's a complex and very intricate arrangement of bones, muscles, as you mentioned, from the skin downwards, fascia, tendon, nerve, ligaments, sort of veins and arteries. Am I correct? That's what you explained just now. But and you also mentioned that it is the most common problem when people come to see you about the hand and wrist is usually pain, pain related. Then you got to, you know, carry out your investigations. But what about red flags? How do we know that this pain is actually a red flag and it's just not going to go away on its own tomorrow?
Okay. I think what you're talking about there is, you know, how do I know that this pain is serious and kind of needs some attention?
Yep.
Usually it's related to limitation of function and stiffness. And I'm surprised sort of how accepting people are of limitation of function, especially if it sort of occurs very slowly. Lady comes to mind is a baker, so she bakes cakes for a living. And she came to me with both hands in a position where she couldn't make a fist up to the point that she couldn't grip something as big as a tennis ball. And I said to her, you know, how did you let it go to the stage? She said, oh, well, you know, I just assumed it was due to aging. And, you know, I have people who assist me in baking, so I could do those, everything that I needed to do could get done. So I said to her, so, you know, why are you here now? And she said, well, I've lost the ability to pinch now, you know, so I can't put my clothes on. I can't put my underwear on because right, I can't sort of hold it properly. And so I'm here. So I said to her, does it hurt? She goes, oh, no more than usual.
Yes, of course.
Right.
So we tend to get used to
it. You tend to get used to it, especially if things happen slowly. So she was sort of the epitome of a good patient. She goes, oh, you know, it's probably acceptable. But really, the hand function shouldn't deteriorate with age that much. I think in general, you should be able to do most things in terms of manual dexterity. Hold fine objects, pinch things, pick up fine things. All those things should not deteriorate that badly with age. Maybe, if there's a sewing needle on the table, you can't pick it up that easily and you need to call somebody to do it for you, that's probably okay. But if you can't pick up a 50-cent coin off the surface of a table, that's probably not so okay.
Okay, so we seem to be relating it to age, thinking that it's a very normal process. So as you said, if that basic functions are deteriorating in a bad way, then perhaps you need some kind of attention.
Yeah, I think you probably need to just sort of work out numbness and tingling is never normal, right? So I think I'd probably say that if there's numbness and tingling in the hand, then that's not normal. And one thing may be interesting is that numbness is sometimes felt as swelling. So people will say, my hands feel swollen, and then I say, well, do they look swollen? Do they look like sausages? Answer is no. Then the next question I ask is, well, does it feel like you have a glove on your hand? Like, does it feel like you had a thick glove on your hand? And they say, yes, it feels swollen because it feels like I have a thick glove on my hand. That's actually a numbness feeling, not a swelling.
Okay. We have Richard. You have a question? Go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, good evening, Mira.
Good evening.
And good evening, Doctor.
Hi, Richard.
All right, just to quickly brief you is that I'm actually suffering from carpal tunnel, and I've done it release. I've done the release twice on both wrists. And of late, my fingers are triggering, and I've already actually done two of my fingers, and I just recently went and did another release on my left ring finger. Doctor, I just wanted to know, how can I prevent my other fingers from triggering?
Okay. Couple of questions. Are you diabetic?
Oh, yeah.
What's your HbA1c? Do you know? The once every 3 month blood test.
It's in the region of 5.7 to 6.
That's pretty good. And how young are you?
Oh, I'm 60.
Okay. Do you smoke cigarettes?
I'm very much involved in sport, especially badminton.
Okay.
I play about 3 times a week.
3 times a week, okay.
Yeah.
All right, and sorry, did I hear you say you don't smoke cigarettes?
No, I don't.
Okay,
I don't.
Great. Okay, thank you for the call,
thank
Richard.
Thank you very much, Richard. We'll answer.
I need.
Yeah, we'll answer that online.
So this is one of those funny things about diabetes. I come to think of it, probably had quite a few patients last week I've had to explain this to. Diabetes as a disease causes soft tissues to get stiff. Now, this is separate from poorly controlled sugars. So the question I asked Richard there was, are you diabetic? He said yes, and I asked him for his number called HbA1c. That's a blood test that they do once every 3 months to look at how good the sugar control is. So this concept here has got two separate parts. So you have to follow the two separate parts. The first part is the fact that you have the diabetogenic gene, and the second part is the fact that your sugars are high. Now, both these things independently cause stiffness of tissues. If you take something like a tendon, which is supposed to glide smoothly, and you make the tendon stiff, it then irritates the lining. And when it irritates the lining gets inflamed. Inflammation makes scar, scar makes inflammation, and the process goes round and round. You do something like badminton, where you're gripping a racket hard for a long time, on an abnormal tendon, on an abnormal lining, you tend to get recurrent inflammation. So trigger and carpal tunnel to me are sort of the end of the spectrum of basically tendon irritation and the complications of the tendon irritation, because I explained to you that all these structures are packed in really tightly. There's very little tolerance of the hand. If you fracture your thigh, chances are if it heals properly, nobody will notice that you fractured your thigh. But if you injure the hand, there's no tolerance in the design of the hand. You will see the injury. Similarly, if you have a tendon that's thick and the tendon's rubbing against the lining, then you tend to get inflammation. That inflammation causes scar. The scar causes carpal tunnel and trigger. So for a 60-plus-year-old man who's had so many treatments already, I think you ask a fair question, which is, how do I prevent it? And the answer is full range stretch. So you really have to work out a stretching program for all the tendons on the palm side of your finger. How do you stretch them properly? Before game, whether you'd consider using an ice pack after the game and stretching again after the game. Those are probably things that you would look at to try and prevent it. The other way of looking at it may be to consider, well, you know, is there another root cause? For example, do you have an inflammatory condition underlying it, like rheumatoid arthritis or something similar, where there's another reason that's driving your inflammation? So your multiple tendon inflammations are either coming from diabetes plus badminton or from some sort of underlying cause that's causing chronic tendon inflammation. And then the triggers and the couples occur. So if you've had so many already, I would say consider trying to work out what's causing that recurrent inflammation. And maybe get that addressed.
So it's not really the carpal tunnel, but what's the underlying cause of it?
Yeah, pretty much. What's the underlying cause?
For those of us who are not too familiar with carpal tunnel, can you just quickly tell us what it is?
Okay, so imagine you are in a tunnel on the highway. Okay, so let's say you're going KL Penang, you know, there's a section around Ipoh where there's a tunnel. Now, imagine you're a bicycle and in the tunnel are other, you know, maybe bicycles, motorcycles. Now, suddenly, in the tunnel comes a lorry on the left, a lorry on the right, and a lorry behind you. So you as the bicycle now become very uncomfortable because the tunnel's gotten very crowded. Mm-hmm. That's basically what happens in the wrist. So what happens in the wrist is there is a passage. The passage has walls and floors made out of bone and a roof made out of sort of very tough material. And there's a bunch of tendons and a nerve that share the passage. It goes from the forearm into the wrist. All things being equal, there's no compression on the nerve. Most people take the view that the roof has come down, and because the roof has come down, the tunnel has become narrow. I find that to be true infrequently. More frequently, I find the problem to be that the contents of the tunnel have become overstuffed. So the tendons have become thick, the lining has become thick, and so the nerve gets compressed. So that's basically what carpal tunnel syndrome is.
And that is because of misuse?
No, that's
or overuse?
Any of a variety of reasons, right? It's just, it's the causation is actually separate. The appreciation of the anatomy is first. Because once you appreciate the anatomy, then you can consider, well, why did this happen? So, I mean, unusual causes are, say for example, somebody may have an anomalous piece of anatomy. So a lady's complaint was, my hands and fingers go numb when I'm reading the newspaper or I'm reading a magazine. That's not true carpal tunnel, because the carpal tunnel syndrome, as originally described, has a prognosis. That means if you do A, B should happen. So you have to get sort of the category right. If you have proper carpal tunnel syndrome, it means that the fingers of the thumb, index and middle, and maybe half of the ring become numb and painful, and the tingling involved, usually around bedtime, usually wakes people up from sleep, usually goes away when you shake the hands. That's idiopathic carpal tunnel, meaning, you know, sort of in the old days we'd accept it as just part of old age. Numbness in the hands, excuse me, is basically any pain, any nervy type pain in the hand is being labeled as carpal tunnel, which is okay, I suppose, if you can say, well, it's sort of a nerve type issue. That's a useful starting point. But the way to look at it is the nerve travels from the root of the neck all the way to the tip of the finger. It's a long journey. That bicycle's gone through a lot of tunnels before it's in that tunnel at Ipoh. Which is in the wrist. Mm-hmm. It's gone through a lot of tunnels before the wrist. So it can get trapped at many places. And one of the common causes of carpal tunnel surgery failure is a failure to diagnose the fact that the nerve is actually trapped at multiple points. So in general, I try to sort of take the approach of multiple points of compression until proven otherwise.
Okay. So the cyclist is the nerve.
The cyclist is the nerve.
The Ipoh is the wrist.
Ipoh is the wrist. The actual tunnel itself, that tunnel at Ipoh is the actual tunnel. And then the content of the tunnel is variable.
And it compresses the cyclist.
It makes the cyclist very uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even have to compress the cyclist. You know, you don't have to be squashed in between the lorries. But it can get very uncomfortable. There are sort of huge rumbling lorries on either side of you. You know, they throw up dust. It's hot. It's uncomfortable.
So how does the nerve react?
By causing pain. That's basically what the nerve reacts by firing. That's what nerves do.
Yep.
You irritate a nerve, it fires off signals. And when it fires off signals, you feel those signals as unusual pain. Not like sort of someone's holding a fire, not like someone's holding a candle, lit candle to my finger kind of pain, but it's an unpleasant feeling. The medical term is called a dysesthesia, which means unpleasant feeling.
So Richard was saying he's released it twice. Mm-hmm. What's actually happening, that surgery to release what?
Okay, so we're basically blowing off the roof of the tunnel.
Huh.
Right, so cyclists in there with the lorries, you take off the roof. Well, cyclist is probably still a bit uncomfortable. If you take the lorries away, then cyclist is probably more comfortable.
Why don't you just take the lorries away?
Because you need to understand the fact that there are lorries in there. That's the thing. So that's why this understanding of carpal tunnel being the space has become narrow is only half correct. You have to ask, why did the space become narrow? So this lady, as telling you about earlier, her hands went numb whenever she held a magazine. And her problem was the fact that she had an anomalous muscle on one of the tendons. And when she made a grip, that muscle was in the tunnel. And so she said, it's really weird. I can do everything with my hands open. It doesn't bother me. But the minute I have to hold something for a period of time, my hands go numb. And so for her, the issue was not to open up the roof, but it was actually to cut away the muscle that was coming into the tunnel.
Right.
I mean, she was lucky. We found it. We saw it under the ultrasound. We gave it an injection of something to kill off the muscle died.
Okay, right? So it's important to get a good diagnosis then.
I would say.
Because I hear of all the time people doing carpal tunnel surgery and, you know, then they say it's the pain is back. It hasn't made a difference.
I would say, look, the carpal tunnel syndrome is not a diagnosis. It's not a disease. It's like saying fever, right? Dengue can cause fever. Cancer can cause fever. Tuberculosis can cause fever. Infection can cause fever. You can't just say fever. You have to say, well, what is the fever due to? I think similarly, you can't just say carpal tunnel syndrome. You have to say irritation of the median nerve at which level by what cause, right? Maybe a little
bit. So it's almost like a symptom of something
else. It is. Actually, no, a carpal tunnel to me, the way we use the term carpal tunnel is really to describe a symptom that, you know, my hands kind of hurt and are numb.
Right.
But really, you have to work out why.
Okay. We have a question here. Does cracking our knuckles cause any physical damage to our hands?
Okay.
Our grandmothers hated us.
They did. Let me explain to you where the noise comes from. If you take,
that's a very good point. Please tell us.
If you take a suction cup and you stick it onto a smooth surface and you pull the suction cup away, you have a popping noise.
Yep.
And the popping noise is made by a phenomenon of physics called cavitation, where the water seal breaks and air is sucked in suddenly, right? It makes a popping sound. And that's exactly what you're doing when you pop your joints. You're just causing cavitation. So the joint normally has a negative pressure within it, and that negative pressure within it is like a suction cup sticking onto a surface. You pull the two surfaces apart. The point at which you overcome the pressure is the point of cavitation, and that causes a pop.
So that is angin la.
It's actually anti-angin.
Thank you. Think about it. It's air.
It is. But it is just you. If you stretch, so say for example now, if somebody came in with excessive fluid in a joint, like a knee, for example, and I suck the fluid out into a syringe, the fluid has got no bubbles in it. If I cap the end of the syringe and I put a strong negative pressure, the fluid has bubbles in it because there's dissolved gases in the fluid. Yeah. And when you put a negative pressure, those gases go from the liquid state into the gaseous state. And that's basically what's happened in the joint. So the dissolved air in the... Well, okay, fine. You win. Angin.
I was just waiting. I'm like, what is this? He's going on.
No, you're absolutely right. I'll concede defeat on that scientific. It's angin.
We're discussing problems to your, you know, hand and wrist. Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon in the studio with us. Please give us a call if you have a question. The number is 0377109000. You can tweet BFM Radio or WhatsApp 0187898899. When we come back, what are some of the home remedies? What's the difference between a sprain and a strain? For an example, the use of painkillers will come and finish finish up after this on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Meera Sivasodhi in our Health and Living segment. Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon in the studio with me. We're trying to get a grip on your hand and wrist problems. We've spoken a lot about the anatomy in the hand. It's very, very different from the rest of the body. It's very complex. It's very intricate. And you know, a whole lot of issues come about because of overuse of the hands. And we often take that the function of the hand and the wrist for granted. I think the use of gadgets now is sort of affecting these problems that are occurring in the hand and in the wrist. More so in the wrist, would you say, Dr. Rajesh?
The wrist is slightly different concept. The wrist is like a gearbox. It transfers force from the forearm into the hand. So wrist problems tend to be, by and large, more traumatic rather than degenerative in my practice.
Okay. Oh, we have a question. Mrs. Mano, you have a question. Go ahead.
Yes. Good evening.
Good evening.
Doctor, the thing is that I am diabetic and my pain is at my elbow. And sometimes when I try to hold my food or grip something with my fingers, I have a cracking sound at my elbow. What is this, doctor? I just don't understand.
Okay. Can I ask you a couple of questions, please, Auntie?
Yes.
Okay, when you put both your hands out in front of you, like if you're trying to sort of stretch both your hands out in front of you, both your elbows come as straight or is one elbow slightly bent?
No, it's straight, but as I stretch, I have a very very painful feeling, very achy. It really aches, you know.
On the outer aspect of the elbow?
Right at my, elbow, the inner part of my elbow.
Not the outer part, the inner part.
The pain is at my the inner part where you put your injection, you know, when you're going for your
right.
blood and all.
Okay, so on this part.
On that part. That.
Okay,
oh,
so
I
the
see,
inner
okay,
part.
The inner part. Okay, got it. All right.
Yes.
That's a bit unusual.
Something.
Sorry?
I have the pain at my outer elbow.
Okay.
When you grip something.
Yes.
Okay.
And there's a cracking feeling.
Okay.
When I hold something, there is a cracking feeling. In fact, I can hear the crack.
Okay.
And it's very painful.
All right. When you try to pick up something, so say for example, if you're eating with your hand, when you're trying to sort of make the ball of food with your hand, is that movement painful? Is it when you try to put it in your mouth that's painful? Which
sometimes
one?
Yes. When I'm taking the food close to my mouth.
When you're taking the food close to your mouth, then it's painful.
Yes, my elbow aches.
Your elbow aches. All right, thank
you.
Thank you very much,
Mrs. Manu. Thank you for that.
Okay, the things I would say there, Mrs. Manu, are it sounds like your problem is more likely coming from soft tissue than from joint. People have this sort of general idea that a cracking sound or noise can only come from cartilage when the surfaces are rough. That's completely untrue. That sort of sensation in medical term is called a crepitus. You can have lots of tendon crepitus. So tendons can be horrifically noisy and not just joints. So your symptoms sound to me like they're probably coming more from soft tissue than from joint. And if you can straighten your elbow fully, then it's unlikely again to be a joint problem. It is rare for me to hear someone say that they can hear a clear sound when they try to move the joint. I'm sorry, but without examining you, I don't really have sort of a clear answer of what direction to go to beyond saying that it's likely to be soft tissue, it's likely to be degenerative. That's probably as far as I can take you with that history. I'm sorry.
Okay. The difference between a sprain and a strain, we will come back and take that that question after Farhan. Farhan, you have a question.
Yeah. Hi, guys.
Hi.
How are you guys?
Good.
Very
thanks,
well, thank you.
Okay, so the question is, recently at night, when I wake up at night, when I lift my wrist, actually when I extend it or when, because you want to push yourself off your bed, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a crack to it, and that only happens like since a few months back.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to ask whether that is because of me lifting weights at the gym, or if it's so, is there any way that I could maybe supplement it through my nutrition that could help with my joints and stuff?
Okay. Some information of Arhan. How young are you?
I'm 28.
All right. And this cracking story only came about after you started with weights at the gym. Is that correct?
Well, not really, because I've been hitting the gym since the past 3 years now. Mm-hmm. So yeah, recently only it's
I see. Okay, so something has changed. So you've had gym for 3 years, push off the bed, no pain recently, or no cracking. That's the other thing. Is the cracking painful or painless?
It feels like, you know how you like there's a tension there, so I need to release it.
You need to release it. Yeah. Okay. That sort of I think that's pretty. Actually, do you smoke cigarettes?
No.
Okay, great. That's helpful.
Thank you very much, Farhan. We'll answer that.
Okay. My approach to it would be to say that that cracking is definitely tendon, right? Or it could be popping of the joint, like Mira said. That would be the second thing. I do think that Farhan's on the right track in terms of saying, well, is it related to my weights? It probably is. It may just be something as simple as the fact that your tendons have gotten a little bit too big or too thick from all your weightlifting. And now when you rest for a period of time, your tendons organize themselves in a certain way. And when you move, they just sort of snap over each other while they're getting reorganized. That's why you get the sense of discomfort or tightness or sort of having to stretch the area. I'd say the thing that you need to do there is you need to go through stretching. You need to go through that gentle full range stretch. So if it's at the back of your hand, then really fold your fingers down towards your palm and try and get sort of a full stretch in the tendon and try and keep it in that position. That would probably be the first thing I would do. Nutritional supplementation wise, you know, you're 28, you're going to the gym, you don't smoke, I'll assume you're not diabetic. I don't think nutrition's going to be the sort of make or break in your situation. I think probably technique modification and stretching is going to be the right direction for you.
Okay, very simple. Just stretch. Some of us are lazy, you know.
Not just stretch, but I think for Farhan with the gym, it's probably technique as well.
Yep.
So, you know, as you push yourself harder, you tend to make more mistakes.
I know it can be, you know, boring to stretch, right? The difference between a sprain and a strain, what does that mean?
Okay, I think it's probably a medical word versus a social word. I think sprain may be a social word. Strain is probably a medical word. The general idea is soft tissues have this thing called a viscoelastic property. So they behave a little bit like a fluid and a little bit like a solid. The best sort of physical example we have of that is a rubber band. So let's say that you have a rubber band and you stretch the rubber band, it stretches back to its same length. That's sort of something where you haven't injured the tendon or ligament or whatever soft tissue it is. But sometimes if you stretch a rubber band a little bit too hard, it doesn't quite go back to its original shape. It's sort of a little bit out of shape, or it takes some time to go back to its original shape. So that could be like a grade one sprain where you've actually, or strain where you've actually got maybe some of the microfibers within the structure are torn, you know, 5-10%. Then grade 2 is where you've torn up to 50%. Grade 3 is, you know, where you've torn 50% or more of your rubber band. So thinking of soft tissues as rubber bands is really very, very helpful if you want to consider skeletal injury, more so in the hand.
Coming back to Farhan's question, what kind of sporting activities increase the risk of hand and wrist injuries?
Actually, it could be anything that involves your hands. So say, for example, if you know, you go at the gym and you do a lateral fly where you're pulling those sort of weights down by the side. Now, the starting position of your wrist in relation to the weight as you curl it down is obviously very important. It may not be such a big deal when you're starting off and you're working up with a light weight, but as you get to heavier weights, if you don't start from the right position or you're at a slight sort of biomechanical disadvantage, then you get back to this wear, tear, repair thing, right? So you've got the wear and tear being accelerated because of poor position and poor technique, and repair just keeping at the rate that it always was. So then you get this mismatch between wear, tear, repair, and that's where you get the cumulative injury.
And the risks of constantly taking painkillers like anti-steroidal, anti-inflammatory drugs?
Non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. Yeah, look, you need to understand a little bit of history here. After the Second World War, there was a very popular compound called Bax powder. So it had three products in it. It had caffeine, phenacetin, and aspirin, APC. The phenacetin was actually nephrotoxic. It killed kidneys. We didn't know at the time, but it killed kidneys. So the historic use of long-term anti-inflammatories killing kidneys sort of comes from there after World War II. The more recent story about long-term anti-inflammatory use is the fact that the whole class of drugs has an effect of increasing the risk of strokes and heart attacks. But, you know, that's like with like 6 months, 9 months, 1 year use. But it also has an exposure-related effect to damaging kidney function. The way the kidney works, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, if you are exposed to very high doses for prolonged periods of time, kill off some of the cells involved in the processing of stuff within the kidney itself.
So it does have phenacetin still?
No, it doesn't have phenacetin. So phenacetin is a bad drug. We're talking now just about the class effect of NSAIDs, mm-hmm. non-selective NSAIDs. It's a class effect. You can't say one class does, one product doesn't have it. Everything in that class has it. More so in Malaysia, where kidney disease is so rampant. So the basic sort of idea is somebody's kidneys already knocked off a little bit due to their hypertension, a little bit due to their diabetes. They're a little bit dehydrated. They take anti-inflammatories. Then it knocks off a little bit more kidney. And then that function just goes round and round. So I know patients whom I've seen where the kidney failure stage 1 or stage 2 is clearly attributable to long-term anti-inflammatory use.
And you can tell?
Well, just by excluding everything else. Are they hypertensive? No. Are they diabetic? No. Have they had any other environmental exposure? No. Is there any is there any structural deficit with the kidney in terms of, you know, the arteries going to it? No. So then all you've got is slightly shrunken and scarred kidneys. And, you know, they say, yeah, you know, no problem. Every time, you know, it hurts. I've been taking this painkiller last 10 years. I've been okay. Well, the 10 years cost.
Yes. So what's your advice on NSAIDs?
My advice on NSAIDs is short-term use. So the analogy I give is inflammation is like a fire. If you have a fire, you douse it with water until the fire completely goes off. You don't just pour a little bit of one glass of water, come back, wait for the fire to become big, then pour another glass of water, go away, come back.
Yeah.
You actually have to douse out the fire. So the correct use of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs is a short course, which should be completed like an antibiotic, because you want to get rid of the inflammation completely. And if you're having to take more than two or three courses for the same problem within a month, then obviously something's not quite right and you should get that attended to.
And what are some of the advancements in microsurgery techniques?
I don't think the techniques improved. The technique of microsurgery basically means that we operate on very small structures using magnification and special instruments. The scale of small has really become very, very small. I mean, there's a field now called super microsurgery where if you were to slice off the very tip of your finger mm-hmm. after your fingernail, right? Now, normally the vessels in that are so small that we'd say they can't be reattached. A Japanese group's actually reattaching them. So you can imagine.
Just at the top of your nail.
Yep. So if you looked at the sort of your finger and you're looking at your nail,
yep.
and you imagine that little sort of sliver of flesh, probably about 2-3 millimeters.
Yep.
If that got sliced off with a samurai sword, the Japanese can fix it back on.
Wow. Super microsurgery.
That's the term, super microsurgery.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's all about getting to smaller and smaller parts.
Smaller and smaller parts.
Such an intricate and, you know, complex arrangement in the hand.
And, you know, the person who's stitching it's still a human being with the limitations of a human being.
Yeah. How are you going to do that?
It's just training. You know, training and interest. I'm quite happy sitting down doing microsurgery for 5-6 hours. It doesn't really worry me.
And a very steady hand.
I think it's just a predisposition. You know, I during my training, I didn't enjoy standing, banging metal rods into long bones. I could do it, but it wasn't fun. Whereas other people didn't find sitting down, looking under a microscope for 6 hours interesting. You know, I loved it.
Yeah. So you're not a carpenter?
I'm a tukang. Let's call it that.
A micro tukang.
A micro tukang. No, that makes me small like a very small hand. Sound like a very small hammer. I have an interest. I have an interest in soft tissue. So I'll say that. So I'm the soft tissue guy. You know, if you wanted to give me a label, I'd take the soft tissue guy.
Okay, all right. If you insist, your message on, you know, hand and wrist problems.
Hand and wrist function shouldn't deteriorate grossly with age. If it doesn't work quite right, probably something's not quite right. you shouldn't accept that it's getting older kind of situation. You know, try and work out exactly what the structural problem is. Is it a tendon, a nerve, a ligament, you know, synovium, whatever. Try and get some sort of anatomic diagnosis, because that'll give you a lot of prognostic information, what you should do, what you shouldn't do, and what's likely to happen in the future.
Okay, thank you very much for joining us today, Dr. Rajesh Singh, consultant orthopedic surgeon, on getting a grip on hand and wrist problems on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.